Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the podcast where comedians talk Red Dwarf. I'm John, and I am rewatching this show for the first time in decades.
And I'm Fergus. I can't stop watching the show, apparently, which kind of qualifies me to be here. We're joined by our producer, Alex, and today we're talking about Series 2, Episode 6, Parallel Universe, with Stuart Goldsmith.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company had evolved. A fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than life.
Our guest this week is Stuart Goldsmith, an award-winning comedian whose recent special, I Need You Alive, is available for free on YouTube at the time of recording. Stu is also the creator and host of the Comedian's Comedian podcast, where he's well on his way to asking every laugh merchant on the planet how and why they do what they do. So having invented the idea of comedians talking about comedy, Stu is effectively the godfather of this very podcast. Now, Stu, I noticed in I Need You Alive that you quote our very own Dave Lister, played for and got from Whitehall. Was that always a knowing reference, or have you, like many of us, just absorbed those quotable lines?
I had no idea.
Did you not?
Until you said that to me.
Amazing.
I played for and got, Jesus. I tell you what, in rewatching the episode ahead of this podcast, I realised the sheer volume of day-to-day language of mine,
yeah,
which is pure Red Dwarf. I topped out around season 7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like, I was a hardcore. I remember watching the first episode as it came out on TV and taking a chance on it, oh, this might be good. And I stayed with it and I watched them all live and I take them all on VHS, and as a weary mid-40s man might suggest. And so I really only half of it do I regard as actual Red Dwarf. Mm. And then there's some other stuff which I respect the listenership to this podcast, probably more than I respect the episodes. No, that's not fair. And having said that, I've just been looking back through it on the iPlayer and going, I mean, that sounds quite a good premise. And I was, that could be good. So I may revisit it, who knows. But I was, for those seasons at least, I used to be able to do chapter and verse.
Right.
And even now, in watching it back, I wouldn't have been able to tell you what was going to happen next, but every time someone gave a feed line, I knew what the punchline was.
Yeah.
And I knew the rhythm and the scansion and all of it. So it doesn't surprise me. It surprises me, but it doesn't amaze me to learn that I say played for and got in a special I've no doubt performed 150 times minimum and never even noticed that. What a lovely thing.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm so pleased. It's kind of more exciting to find out that it was just in there. It's in the collective unconscious.
I think my love for and enthusiasm for the first 6-ish seasons, I consider myself a Red Dwarf fan.
Mm.
and I could fight over it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like there are a few things of which I'm a fan. Like my friend comedian Richard Sandling referred to me as a double agent. He said, if you were at my school, we'd have called you a double agent. And what he meant by that was you can hang out with the nerds, but you can also pass amongst the cool people, right? I don't think he said cool, mainstream. Right. And that is true. I can't do who was the director of photography on XYZ. I can't do what date did such and such come out. But I have lived and breathed Red Dwarf for a long time. And it's one of the few fandoms I feel like I could back myself just knowing what it's about and what it's really about and the rhythm of it and the place it has in my life. It's one of the few things which I'm like, 100% I'm replying to this email and going on your show.
Yeah, I can very much relate to that. That's exactly the experience I'm having going through the podcast, actually doing a big rewatch. And yes, that thing where you're watching an episode and you suddenly go, oh, this bit, that's where that comes from, that thing that I've been saying for the last 25 years. Yeah, it's just a testament to the writing, isn't it? So you said you come in right at the beginning, Stuart, episode one, series one. How old would you have been then?
So I'd have been 16.
Right.
And I watched it with my brother, and he is maybe 4 or 5 years younger than me, and we took a risk on it, and I don't remember a lot about my childhood, much to the annoyance, I'm sure, of my parents and other people who were involved in it. But I have an incredibly clear memory of me and my brother rolling around on the floor crying with laughter watching the first episode.
So were you kind of hooked immediately from that point? Did it become appointment viewing for you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, I'm a sci-fi fan now. I don't know if it was the first sci-fi I was ever introduced to. I struggle to think of other. I mean, we might have watched a bit of Star Trek, but it would have been early Star Trek then. And I don't know. I don't remember that grabbing me particularly. The shot of the dwarf open, that gargantuan ship, and zooming in and seeing a little guy painting. Like the amount of work that does. Annoyingly, the episode I rewatched for this doesn't open with that shot. It's probably the only one that doesn't open it. But you know, the disappearing into the kind of thrusters at the end of the episode. The shape of it, the size of it, I think that opening shot does an incredible amount of work in setting up the world of the show. The loneliness of this little man doing a menial task. It's just a perfect intro. And I'd probably never seen, you know, I'd have seen like, what's the one with the little robot, a floaty robot called Maximilian?
The Black Hole.
The Black Hole, thank you. I'd have seen that, which, you know, and there was a movie called... There was a movie called Ice Pirates. Ooh, anyone remember that?
Oh my. No.
No? Oh, check out Ice Pirates. I imagine it's aged like milk. But it was like a future pastiche type movie. They were fighting over ice. You know, water's a resource, what have you. That has definite vibes in common with Red Dwarf, in that it's a kind of futuristic pastiche. I must have seen Spaceballs before I'd ever seen Star Wars.
Right.
You know, so I came to it in a funny sort of a way. But that very first episode, absolutely hooked.
It's really interesting what that does, that opening shot. You could take it one way and go, oh, you know, you're promising us so much with those special effects and with those visuals, and now we just get stuck in a bunk room. But actually...
Oh, God, I'd never felt shortchanged.
No, I don't think you do, because what it does is, as you say, it just... You put it perfectly, emphasises the loneliness, the tininess of the existence they've got. They've got the whole universe at their disposal and nothing to do.
And they do that ship so well, in the way that what Star Wars does brilliantly, and when Star Wars rolls over and dies, it's because they forgot to do this, is to make everything look beaten up and moth-eaten and worn. And that's why you want to be in the world of The Mandalorian or whoever, because they look...
Yes.
They do mean that's what they look like, real objects in your life. And I suppose as it went on, things look shinier.
True.
And the models looked shinier and spacier and less like that opening shot. If they could have stuck with that style, and they just nailed it. The fact he's painting it, obviously it's a riff on Painting the Fourth Bridge, which I suppose I hadn't realised till now. But paint hoop. I mean, just realised the insanity of painting the outside of a spaceship.
Yeah.
That had never occurred to me until now. Who's that for? But what it really emphasised for me was just the fact the tiny little man doing an infinitely long job.
Yeah, no, it's awesome.
Did you wear your fandom of Red Dwarf on your sleeve? Like, were you open about
it? Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've never been ashamed of it. I've never been embarrassed about any of that nerdy stuff. I never would have needed to. I wasn't, like, popular. I've just got a personality that tends to get on with other people when I'm not ranting to their faces about how popular and likeable I am. But I never felt confined. Let's not say options. I didn't feel confined or constricted by it. I felt like, this is awesome. And I'll talk to anyone and they'll walk away. You know, but I was like at school, I was so kind of age wise, I would watch Lenny Henry doing the Delbert Wilkins show and then go in the next day and repeat all the sketches in what I assume was a variety of alarmingly racist accents. You know, like I was like, I've seen a thing and I'm desperate to tell my friend Richard Lawson all about it, you know.
So speaking of relatability then, Stu, how do you relate to the characters?
Well, I think there are two wolves inside of you and they're Rimmer and Lister.
Love
right?
It.
That's, I mean, yeah. I think that's true of everyone. I didn't relate to the cat on any kind of level other than the cat is just, you know, the cat is Prince, the cat is cool as the epitome is cool. I hated Dwayne Dibley. I hated the Dwayne Dibley episodes.
Oh.
They felt like such a, they just felt like an atrocity against the cat. Do you know what I mean? They felt like a crime against the cat. I love Crichton to bits. But I think there are key decisions probably in my life that I made because I wanted to be like Lister.
Oh, wow.
I went to a very buttoned-down school. And a lot of my life, the reason why I got into comedy, the reason why I got into street performing a lot sooner, as a teenager, I became a street performer. Those were attempts to break out of what I perceive to be society's rules, man. And I think having Lister as a sort of an avatar of that, the key Lister scene for me is the Inquisitor. And that hit me so hard. You know what you could have been, Dave. You know what you could have become. So, just the fact that his answer was just so... So, like, I wanted to, I cared passionately about not caring that much. Because I did care, but I was like, God, imagine if you didn't care. And you could just look, you know, you could look judgment in the eye and say, spin on it. You know, that quality of Lister. And also, I was a very scruffy sort of a dresser. If I had arguments with my dad when I was a teenager, they were all about me looking really scruffy. But I would kind of prize it. Because it was not, I don't think consciously that it was Lister, but I think it made, the show had such an impact on me. It sort of, it wrote into my DNA this idea of like slobbing around and being, and I don't know if this comes up in the show, but I remember reading the book, Infinity Welcomes Careful Drivers. I've read that a few times and it has that section about, I think it's Rimmer thinking about his choice of car and he's going, well, maybe Lister's the bigger man because he doesn't need a dick replacement car. You know what I mean? He's happy with a humble sort of a car. And that's important to me as well. Like, it's important to me. I like earning money, but I've always felt dirty about it. And part of that is that kind of the Lister-ness in me, which is like, I don't care what car I drive. I'd rather have a banger that I can bump into things and not give a damn.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Whereas I think the two wolves thing is there is so much about Rimmer. Every time I smile when I'm being insulted, I think, oh God, I am Rimmer. I smile when I'm being insulted. You know, the extent to which he is a bruised product of an unforgiving public school system, I relate to that hard. And I just, you know, Lister is so self-assured and I want to be Lister, but deep down I'm Rimmer.
Yeah.
The amazing thing about Lister is he pulls off that laissez-faireness.
Yes.
Without being a psychopath, he's still a humanist. He still loves people.
Yeah,
that's quite a feat, and that is inspirational, aspirational.
Yes, it is. He's human, and he has empathy and all those things. Whereas Rimmer is the person I think I am when I'm bullying myself. He's
right,
the, you know, in the kind of mental health way. He's the bully, and he's also the bullied. And so many of those things written into the language of how I, God, I mean. There's so many examples. That thing about him, when Rimmer's on trial and they say, this preposterous man who is the security guard at the front gate who considers he's in charge of the factory. I am pompous in that way. I have an overblown sense of my own importance sometimes and I catch myself. And the language for which I reach in order to explain myself to myself is so completely written by Red Dwarf. Mm. I probably sound a bit ranting and mad now.
No.
I think I'm a lot more into this than even I had realised.
Yeah, there's no judgment here. It's actually very relatable. It's really interesting, a lot of what you've just said, Stu, and it sounds as if Lister was a big deal for you as a teenager, and that makes sense because a lot of what makes Lister cool is quite teenage, right? It grows out of you, or you grow out of it as you grow up.
Rewatching it now as a 46-year-old man, I'm like, well, I still like this guy, but I can't back his choices.
That's it, yeah. He's suddenly not quite cool. We've had this conversation a lot on the pod. It's like, oh, I'm sure he was cool when we were young. He's not really cool. He is cool, but he's not cool.
He's still pretty cool. I was heartbroken when I found out that Craig Charles was wearing fake dreadlocks. heartbroken.
Well, on the plus side, at least it means when he gets some chopped off by Rimmer in the body swap episode, at least he wasn't vandalised for real in that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Is Rimmer in the ascendant as you've got older?
That's a good question. No, I think Crichton is. I think actually.
Ah, cool.
Yes, I'm much more attracted now within the obvious remit of being a self-involved narcissistic comedian whose life and work is all about himself. I'm much more interested in utility now and helping, and I get such a buzz from being useful. One of the things I love about my podcast is that it's useful to people and they get in touch with me and go, God, this helped with this. Or they'll stop me in a train station and go, I just wanted to say this. Oh, I'm so meaningful. And that's much more important to me now than a round of applause or a big laugh. When I was a new dad, so my kids are like 5 and 8 now, because this is a way of seeing the world that is completely informed by one specific joke on one specific episode of Red Dwarf, my assumption is that it has resonated as hard with every fan as it does with me. So forgive me if this comes up all the time. But as a new dad, the line, Arnold, where are the nappy sacks? That is what it's like being a new dad. And I knew it would be like that. I became it and it was like that. I'm out of the tunnel now and it's not like that anymore. But that line is, it is so perfect, because it's not wrong of her to be looking for the nappy sacks, but it's like you steal a moment with your mate and you are dragged back to the mundanity of the all of the awful tedious things about being a parent. That isn't the whole of parenting by any means, but it really is emblematic of one of the biggest struggles that I had with it. So I was probably Lister. I hope this means I'm going to be Cat when I'm in my 80s. But I think I was Lister, and then I flirted with Rimmer, and now I hope and I aspire to be much more like Crichton. And because now I'm very happy, I still struggle with anxiety and various bits and bobs, but broadly speaking, I'm very happy. I thought of this recently, and my son hasn't seen Red Dwarf yet. He's the older. And I would like to involve him in it. I considered watching the episode that I rewatched with him. I'm glad I didn't. It would have been a bad call for a kid.
It's a tricky one.
It's a tricky one. But I was trying to explain to him. No, I gave up on. I had the thought of I should explain this to him, and then didn't, about the bit where they ask Crichton where he'd like to go back in time to. Mm. And he says last Wednesday or last Tuesday. Don't you remember? Like I did the washing up, and then we watched TV. That self-actualization and peace, I hope I live, because that's who I want to be and that's who I try to be in front of my kids.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's really lovely. And it is pertinent probably to the conversation we'll have later that Doug Naylor had, I don't know if he'd become a dad or was about to become a dad. I think he might have recently become a dad, and that played out in all sorts of ways in terms of them considering what to do with the end of Parallel Universe. And I just realised, of course, that's got a bearing potentially on the Better Than Life episode where that happens, where Rimmer's nightmare is to become surrounded by all these kids.
That bit is written by a dad struggling with being a dad, surely.
There you go.
I mean, listen, art is art, and maybe it was a 90-year-old lady who'd never had kids writing that joke. You know, it's art, isn't it? But to me, that is like, that's someone right in the epicenter of the storm of parenting multiple children.
You've said you clocked out after Series 7, Stu, but looking back, do you have a favourite series out of those first six?
The first series is so good at establishing what's going on. And Confidence and Paranoia, I was lucky, I guested on Craig Ferguson's show.
Oh, did you?
And it may, if there are socials images attached to this thing, or listeners know me, I look an awful lot like a young Craig Ferguson. like it gets pointed out a lot. And not necessarily the kind of tanned white teeth version of it in that. Because what they're so good at doing is to take a concept and explore it, really explore it in a silly way. The earlier series are the best because the concepts are clearer. Series 2 is pretty incredible. Stasis Leak, that's incredible. Queeg's amazing. Probably if you'd asked me at the time of like the peak of my fandom, I'd have said 3. Right. Marooned is obviously the best episode. Polymorph has got some of the best jokes in it. Body Swap's really funny. Backwards, oh my God, Backwards. I think he says Magnumuk. Like, I'm pretty sure it's those noises. Time Slides is great. The Last Day is great. Justice, incredible. White Hole, oh my God. Mm. I've never seen one before. No one has. I was hoping that you were going to give me White Hole, because it, the time loopness of White Hole is my favourite genre of movie is time right. loop, and it's a perfect episode.
Well, you gave us White Hole in your special. That's where that line comes from.
Is that one? Is that where it's from? Yeah, I didn't even know. That's priceless. Now, tricky, right? Dimension jump. Mm-hmm. When we start smoking people kippers, I start to wobble.
Ah, interesting. Right?
Like the purity of the character.
100%. It, to me, coming up with alternate reality versions of the characters, which are jokes about the central things, sort of is in danger of becoming, and apologies because I learned this word very recently and I'm using it all the time, flanderization. Do you know about flanderization? Ooh. You can find a proper description on the tvtropes.org website, but a friend of mine sent it to me, and it's when a character which is nuanced and rich gets overtaken by their one joke.
Ah, right.
Mm. Yeah? So the Dwayne Dibley is a sort of a symptom of the flanderization of Cat.
Right.
And Ace Rimmer is a symptom of the flanderization of Rimmer, I think.
Right.
And it's far less interesting to me to choose one part of Rimmer and spoof it than it is to actually hear from actual Rimmer. So I started, I was like, okay. Having said that, Holoship's great, Inquisitor's great. Back to Reality is brilliant. Then Gunmen of the Apocalypse, it's not a bad episode, but it starts to get a bit holodeck.
Right.
It starts to get a bit like, next time we'll be in Shakespearean England and next time we'll be in, you know what I mean? And it's a bit like, okay, but are we talking about an actual thing like justice? Are we exploring something about feminism? Or are we just putting funny hats on the characters and sending the lads out there again? And I sort of started dropping off around there. What I want is them to explore a pure idea. There's a reason Marooned is the best episode. It's the characters interrelating, learning stuff about each other, in conflict. Everything moves forward and says something about something.
Yeah.
I just love Norman Lovett. Just love Norman. Just what's happening, dudes? Just that, you know, when he's dancing, when he first meets Hilly and they kiss and he's there and they're like, you've got a bit of lipstick on your face, and he says, "What face?"
Yeah, that's
or
awesome.
In, you know, when they're he's built the Holly Hop Drive and they activate it, and he says, "There's nothing there. There's just not." Oh, sorry, I was looking at the wrong window. You know, it's such a good idea to have an infinitely powerful AI ship's computer. That's crap. It's such a good idea. That's very specifically crap in a very British, mundane way. It is such a joyful idea, and the warmth and his sort of internal shrug that Norman Lovett brought to it, I thought was just wonderful.
Yeah,
he's magic.
He is. They're all magic. But what would you do, Stu, if you had to recast them all?
I find it hard to remember actors. So I could cast it from comics, but I might end up casting it from comics that your listenership doesn't necessarily know. I think my first thought for Lister is Nish.
He's come up a few times, you know.
Has he? For Lister?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I used to live with him and he's a f***ing slob. I don't know the extent to which Nish acts, but let's not be bound by that. I think that... I think Nish's attitude to kind of fast food and pints is very Lister. I think that Rimmer has to be Matt Ewins. Matt Ewins is an absolutely incredible comic. It will be things like he'll have spent 4 months programming a computer game from scratch so that someone in the audience does a sort of GTA version where they walk around a shop trying to find a bad guy, and they do have agency in the game, and then at the last minute the controls take over and they shoot the bad guy's child. Do you know what I mean? It's like incredible rug pull. Enormous. Anyway, he's very tall. If you check out a picture of Matt Ewins, 1T, Matt Ewins online, make sure it's actually him because he deliberately sends press photos of other comedians to magazines. Do you know what I mean? He's a lunatic. But he would make a phenomenal Rimmer. And on that note, I think Mark Silcox for Holly. I don't know if you'll know Mark. He is an older comic. He does a show called I Will Cure that he's done at many Edinburgh festivals, and slightly he's like a sort of absurdist anti-comic where he will make everyone in the audience a cup of tea for an hour, and that's the show. And he has a wonderful... He's not like Norman Lovett at all, but he has a similarly quirky... Oh, and I just thought Ed Axel would make a storming Holly if you were trying to go for something similar. Do you mean something similar, but age swapped? I think Ed Axel would be wonderful for that. Who else? I mean, Tom Allen would make a good cat. Well, I think because he's so nicely
that would
put
be really
together.
Interesting, actually.
I don't think of Tom as vain. Honestly, I said to myself, Stu, you can just riff this. I should have put more work into it.
You've done seriously well. That's a great cast.
You do need a Crichton as well.
I feel like I could do Crichton. I can feel like I could do Crichton in enough makeup.
Why not?
That's the sort of job I fear I'd get, where I'd be like, everyone else is rocking out having fun and I'm in makeup for 6 hours every time. I'd be like, oh yeah, great. You know, it's what me and my friend, my Streak Before We Friends, called being a successful failure. If I ever got in a Marvel movie, it would be one where I never met the rest of the cast and it all took place in a room on my own on a string. And you know what I mean? It'd be one of those like Oscar Isaacs as Apocalypse or whatever. Like, I hate this. So maybe not me for Crichton. Who could be? How about Glenn Moore for Crichton? I think Glenn Moore would be good.
Yes, perfect.
I can see that. This is great. We're gonna break out a whole bunch of new stars here.
Yeah.
And Suze Kempner. Suze Kempner could do Holly.
Holly for Suze.
Yes, she could. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that would be really nice actually. Right, well, we have smashed that particular parallel universe of the recasting. Now it's time to smash parallel universe the episode.
Thanks, John. For the first time in Red Dwarf, we forego the usual sombre opening for an all-singing, all-dancing musical number. It turns out we're watching Cat's dream recording, a glimpse into a parallel universe where he's a pop star with the worst hype men money can buy. Holly interrupts some classic banter to announce he's invented the Holly Hop Drive, a machine which will allow the ship to go anywhere in the universe in an instant. Lister, of course, chooses home. However, let's not forget that Holly is demented. The Hollyhop Drive has taken Red Dwarf to another dimension, a parallel universe where they immediately find an identical Red Dwarf, whose ship's computer is female. The male crew of the Red Dwarf board the other Red Dwarf, and Cat immediately smells something he doesn't like. And then we meet them, the female versions of Lister and Rimmer. They're in a universe specifically where the history of gender politics and feminism has been inverted. Jeremy Greer, Wilma Shakespeare, Nellie Armstrong. It's the same as our universe, but the reproductive organs have been swapped. And more than we realise at this stage. Cat is excited to meet his female counterpart. However, we are told and then see that Cat's opposite in this dimension is a dog. Cat is very cat about it, showing immediate disdain and superiority, while Dog is classic Dog, ignoring the unease with gestures of fun and friendship. The six characters go to the most depressing nightclub in the universe and get to drinking and chatting. Following some truly awkward conversation, female Rimmer becomes very sexually aggressive, making male Rimmer squirm. It is creepy and a useful reminder of what it's like to be in that position in our universe. Lister is having more fun at first, but eventually even he becomes a little disgusted with the reflection of himself. Rimmer runs away and hides from himself, herself. Lister wakes up next morning sharing a bunk with Lister. Turns out while crazy drunk the night before, they had sex. Quite the act of narcissism, but we have to give them a buy. It's been 3 million years. However, and please ignore the science, seriously, it's men that get pregnant in this universe. Uh-oh. If Lister's up the duff, Milado, then that would tie in with the whole Future Echoes thing showing us he had two kids. Holly repairs the Holly Hop Drive and the male crew hightail it out of there. Lister takes a pregnancy test. Cliffhanger. It's positive. He's pregnant. Rimmer's going to be an uncle. End of series. Stuart, there's a lot to discuss with this set. There's loads of references and jokes and interesting bits of trivia. But I think we should start with the big topic. It's a politically delicate subject, definitely contentious. And of course, we do have to discuss how well it's aged. I am, of course, referring to Tongue Tied.
I loved it then and I love it now and I sang along to every word. I absolutely love it. It completely showcases the marvel that is Danny John Jules. And it was like, you know, you sort of go, you realise after that bit, you sort of think, oh yeah, of course, it's sort of arbitrary, whatever dream they looked back at. So they just kind of went, what dream could we do? Well, Danny's an unbelievable singer and dancer. Let's do that. And then you've got, and to be fair, what I really enjoyed noticing more details about it this time, such as the their different takes on being backing dancers. Yes. You know, the fact that Rimmer is really, he's really doing his best.
Yeah.
He really is. Ramrod straight, you know, really kind of trying to do it. Whereas, you know, Lister is sort of doing his best after a fashion, you know.
And doing some facial interpretations of the lyrics, adding to it.
Yeah. It's a well-written song for a throwaway. Did it go on to become a single? Did they release it?
They did release it as a single a few years later, weirdly.
The fact that that they do that kind of backing line of digestive system, and then later on they do the mirror of it of reproductive system. Like that seems to me, to my untrained ear, to be a very well-structured, funny song.
That backing, Midnight Train to Georgia style backing vocal, the question and response.
Yeah.
That is Craig Charles and Chris Barry doing those backing vocals as well. Not the woo-hoo bits, but the reproductive system, baby. Yeah, that's actually them.
Love it. Because and they managed to get so much mileage out of that one joke of like, please believe me when I say Gaddafi, durable, flurry do, you know, all that kind of thing. it's really lovely. Yeah.
In the documentary, Naylor's saying like it became less funny and more funky or something. So I'm not sure how pleased they were with the final version.
Yeah. Because then Danny smashed it and they're like, oh, it wasn't supposed to be that good. Yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic. Yeah, thanks, Alex. The moment when Danny does, I mean, I don't even know what the words are, but he does a sort of a leaping kick to a sort of swan power slide thing. You just go, that's a dancer, that looks amazing. I don't care for it, but that guy's doing it.
It's cool that he can do it. Yeah.
Should we just mention as well that it was choreographed by Queeg?
Yeah, that's true. Charles Organs, who played
Queeg. Yes, I think I knew
that's why he was there, right? That the choreographer was the first job Charles Organs had on the show, and then they cast him as Queeg when they saw
Queeg 500. I love it.
And didn't he monopolise the rehearsal time, right, Alex? Am I remembering this correctly? That Ed Bai, the director, got really annoyed with how much time Charles Organs was taking, getting the guys away to learn or not learn the choreography in the case of Craig and Chris.
But it would have been particularly irksome on this episode, right? For three quarters of your rehearsal time. If that was for, I don't know, almost like Polymorph, where there's a lot of action that you had to direct, that you could have had relatively little rehearsal time. But this, they're introducing four new characters, all with speaking roles who have complexities about them. I'm sure Ed Bai was biting his fist.
It's a good point. I never really see those things in terms of like, well, this must have been a production nightmare. Like, if that had been me, what you wanted, given that the dream is effectively arbitrary, it does echo the plot, but, you know, it doesn't need to be anything. It could be anything.
Not at all.
Surely you'd get three quarters of the episode in the can and then do that with whatever time you had left. On Ed Bai. If he's got a problem with that, that's on him.
I like to think Organs just turned around to him every time and just gave him the eyeball and called him a sucker, and Bai just kind of crawled back.
They kind of say that in the documentary, that Charles Organs is very much like Queeg, like a taskmaster, and kind of didn't really brush Ed off when he was like, can we grab them to rehearse this, please?
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, he's used to, I assume, like Broadway theatre, where you have to brush off the producer director to get stuff done.
By the end of the shoot, Ed Bai's just in a flat cap and a little scarf, sweeping the backstage.
It had been a while since sitcoms had musical interludes, right? The Young Ones did it. And actually, funnily enough, I find the cut from the video to Kat looking and going, that's the wrong one. That feels like a Young Ones edit gag.
Yes. Yes, you're right. It does a bit, doesn't it?
The nonchalance with which they're just destroying that dream reality.
Yeah.
Sure.
Shall we talk about the big thing? Should we talk about gender politics in this app?
Sure.
Do you think they got it right in this episode?
Yeah, it's a pretty straight down the line. Men are scum. It's a harder watch now because you sort of recognise the way that female Rimmer treats Rimmer is so abrupt. And it's such a sort of slap in the face. And you watch it now, like at the time it was sort of funny because I was a teenager and I kind of got it, I guess. And now you watch it and you're like, whoa, there's a real kind of underlying malevolence. Mm. And because it's couched in funny language like Totty, you know, it didn't seem as kind of problematic at the time. Deliberately problematic, written to be problematic. And you kind of clock it now and you're much more like, whoa, they were really saying something. They were really pointing something out in a way that I think I got the vague idea, but I didn't get the malevolence. Even with Lister and Lister, you know, the kind of the pregnancy thing of just like, well, come on, you know, with the whole wham, bam, thank you, mister thing. Her kind of laissez-faire attitude to, well, you should have taken precautions. Sorry, mate, what do you want me to do about it? That sort of, even though Lister is the good guy, you really get a sense of like, whoa, look how kind of lazy, look how much he doesn't give a shit. And it's funny when men are talking about it. And then when you see it happen to men, when the positions are, I think I'm sure they did exactly what they set out to do in a very abrupt slap in the face kind of a way.
I've seen Doug Naylor talking about it. I don't know how recent the footage was. I don't think it's super recent. But he is definitely embarrassed by it. And he makes some comments to the effect of, oh, it's a 12-year-old's view of women or something. And I found it really weird because, to me, the episode is not about women. The episode is about men.
There's no women in it. There's no women in it. They're effectively male characters. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It's almost like he's forgotten what they wrote to establish that this is a mirror universe where they're men, they just happen to be in the other body. Like, that's, this is all about male attitudes.
Yes, they're holding a mirror up to men in a way that I think exactly, worked at the time and I think stands up.
Yes.
Given the context of the time it was in, they were, you know, it was quite a write-on. What would this have been? Like early 90s, late 80s? So, you know, there was the Comedy Store and the Young Ones and what have you. So there was definitely alternative comedy breaking against the sort of established norms. But I think in that way that a lot of the early series did, they took a subject and they made a load of really funny, silly jokes about a serious subject that allowed them to unpack that subject and give loads of examples. And I hope that that episode contributed to other people's, and I hope it contributed to me being way less sexist as a teenager than I might have been.
Yeah, right.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The fact of having a kind of a callback or a call forward, you know, to the fact of the two babies and then ending the series on it felt like really good writing. That felt kind of, I remember sort of really sitting up at that point and going like, it all fits together. Whoa.
Yeah, right.
They do set up the niceness of the first two series being a contained thing. They do set up, like, they very specifically, Kat has a couple of lines that he says from episode one. Better make myself look big is the first thing he says on seeing Lister and Rimmer, right? Rimmer quotes Lister, right? That's cool. That does it. There's something about that makes you feel good and clever.
Yeah,
and
right.
Which bit do you
towards the end, Rimmer says, do you remember, Lister? You said, I don't know how I'm going to get two kids,
but it'll be a lot of fun finding out. Yes, of course.
That is a direct quote.
And it's so satisfying because the meaning is totally reversed in that with it coming out of Rimmer's mouth. I love that.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Rimmer's delight. The delight is so good. This is why I think all I really want from Red Dwarf is those four or five characters in a room. The best of it is all about, are you sure, sir, it will mean changing the bulb? You know what I mean? The best of it, the best jokes, the best character development are just those characters being in a room together. What do you do when you've got nothing to do and you just bicker? I could have watched that for series after series.
The Holly Hop Drive is a red box. Is that a reference to the cheapness of props generally? I maybe started overthinking this one because I saw it as, is it not a fight back from the props department to say, well, what else do you need?
Yeah, I mean, you may be right. You may be right. I don't know. I think it's a setup for a gag, isn't it? That is that brilliant joke of, you know, there's two buttons on it. The green one that says start, you press that when you want to start, and I'll let you work out the rest yourself. Just absolutely brilliant. You know, they needed, like, the job of build that box for the gag to work. They wrote the gag first, right? So the gag must have been, make us an incredibly simple box with a start and a stop on it. I don't know.
Read the script. It's Lister says it's a red box.
Yeah. I've just remembered this in the context of this conversation. I hosted a sci-fi series on CBBC. It was called Mission 2110. And if anyone Googles my name and Mission 2110, you will see the most incredible sci-fi picture of me, taken by the guy who at the time was doing all of the Doctor Who pictures. Three huge robots in the background and me wearing a leather jacket looking like adventure hero guy.
Sweet.
It was a combinate, mate. It was, you'd love it. You can find, I think you can either find it on YouTube or one of the people that claims to be my fans will probably hook you up with an archive, like a drive link to all the episodes. We recorded like 26 episodes or something. And it was the Crystal Maze meets Terminator in the future, right? For kids.
Oh, wow.
It was so Red Dwarf. We did so much running away from explosions. There were giant towering robots. And I used to go to Millennium FX in the build-up to it with all of this stuff nearby that they were like, NDA, you can't see any of it, you can't discuss any of the stuff. And they would, you know, cast me for a, you know, cast bits of my face for prosthetics and stuff. So we were going through those kind of budgetary chats whereby Millennium, obviously CBBC, the BBC had spent a fortune on these roboid creatures, which incidentally you'll recognise them because they turn up several times in Doctor Who. Greg Davies is sort of in one. There's like a version of it with a screen on it.
Right.
There's several uses of them because they were like, well, we bought the kits, let's do something with these. But we went through budget chats of like, right, Millennium are going to make me a prosthetic. And then it was further down, it's like, we've run out of money. We'll make you a prosthetic, but it'll be metal. And it was like, okay, it's going to be clay. It's going to be a, we've got a Casio watch and gaff it to your head kind of thing. With all due respect to the brilliant people working on that show, just to be on the, I was on the inside of that whole kind of, you know, those conversations about how you're able to afford stuff. And I just thought if people listening to this are obviously Dwarf or Doctor Who fans, that might entertain. I mean, to be honest, we made that 14 years ago. So many of the 9 and 10, 11-year-old kids who were in that will now be adults who could conceivably be listening to this podcast, unless it put them off sci-fi for life. It may interest you to know, as sci-fi fans, and I'm obviously a sci-fi fan, being the person in the image, it's cool. I'm pleased it exists, but I can't go back there. And I'm not that guy. I had a mate who was like a completist. He loved Alien and he ended up buying every box set. He'd have the Alien quadrilogy and then they'd make another movie and he'd have to buy the new one. And all of it, I think, was an attempt for him to somehow be in the movie Alien. Hmm. And you can't be, and they know that's what you want, and that's how they screw you for loads of money. And even the people in Alien, I realised, this tempered a lot of my sort of jonesing, desperation, envy years ago. Even the people who were in Alien can't be in Alien again. That was past. So that just occurred to me as a thought.
You know, you're kind of just describing the whole endeavour of acting, right? Mm. It probably works even as a stand-up, right? Like, you've got to say goodbye to things you did and created, even though they live on in the fans' minds.
With stand-up, I would say that's what one of the things that drew me to stand-up as opposed to acting. I went to the same drama school that John did, it turns out, for like a post-grad course. We didn't meet there. And I was lucky to work. I worked in rep for a few years, and it was great. The people were great. I was bored. I was terribly bored. I taught myself to unicycle during the half, you know, doing a thing in a theatre in Keswick, because everyone was getting into character. And I just think on some important level, I just didn't care. I realise now I have ADHD, and I did at the time and didn't know. The difference is, as an actor, on Mission 2110, I ran down a corridor with explosions going off. I did that. It was amazing. Mm. But you do it once and then maybe you retake it and then maybe you retake it and then you go and have lunch. And it isn't what I thought it was, which would be living the life of a man who runs down an exploding corridor. Yeah, it isn't that.
Yeah.
Acting, you just do, especially film acting, movie acting, those kind of things. In my understanding, you do a tiny bit of the thing and then it's over and you go back to your trailer and blah, blah, blah. Stand up, you do actually do the thing. If you play a cop or a sci-fi hero in a movie, you aren't that. But if you are a stand-up, you are that. And that was a huge pull for me to get me out of acting and walk out of my acting agent's office that I'd put so much effort into getting an acting agent. And then the day I walked out, I was just like, ah. Oh. The rehearsal for running down the corridor, before they set the explosions off, the director, James, said to me, right, run down. He sort of had a word with me and he sort of said, right, we need this a big shot. We're just going to run it without the explosions one time. When you run, sort of run a bit in slow motion, a bit like a hero, just really hero it up. So I did that and everyone burst out laughing and he said, ah, you look like a twat. It was great. It was just a deliberate absolute wind-up to make you behave like a f***ing in front of everyone.
Oh, that's great directing really, and awful directing.
Oh,
that's brilliant.
It was so funny. It was so funny.
Oh no, he really stitched you up.
He really did. I really was like, oh God, this is exactly that. The moment I've dreamt of. Right, this is, I guess they do. I guess Tom Cruise is thinking, I'm a big hero. I'll channel that. Dun, 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 dun. Like, he was like, it looks f-ing ridiculous.
Maybe he was deliberately getting you out of your own head a little bit for it as well. Like, you can never look as bad as you did in that go.
Yeah, maybe, rehearsal, maybe, so. Maybe.
I'd love to chat about some specific jokes in this episode, because they come pretty thick and fast, and some of them are amazing comedic ideas that just, they disappear. Anyone collecting awesome Chris Barry faces is surely a fan of the mesmer stare. Like, if you're playing Chris Barry face bingo, that is amazing. He must have practiced that in the mirror. What's he seeing?
Yes, well, he's a sort of brilliant impressionist, isn't he, Chris Barry? So he's one of those incredibly flexible, precise face guys. That's how
he's got
it.
A very flexible and precise, so expert. Yeah, very rubbery and brilliant. But yeah, he's got the same thing as Rowan Atkinson, just an ability to make a face and for that out of context to be kind of funny.
Yeah,
I got strong Gordon Britas vibes from the mesmer stare. Actually, it really made me think of that performance.
Yes, it's funny that it never really stuck with me. I watched a bit of Britas, but he was sort of Rimmer, wasn't he?
Maybe Britas fans would say Rimmer's kind of Britas.
Well, which came first? Didn't Rimmer come first? Surely Rimmer.
Yeah, Rimmer came first. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, Britas was more connected to the world than Rimmer was, from what I can remember.
Yes, fair dues. He gave such a powerful performance as Rimmer that seemed complete. Yeah. He was Rimmer as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
I hate it when Craig Charles DJs. Come on, Lister, get back on your ship and stop talking bollocks about funk.
Stop moonlighting. Talking of Chris Barry, his reading of We're Going to Die. Now, if you're a comic actor, any actor worth your soul, and you get the line, We're Going to Die, his interpretation to go, we're going to die, is extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's so good. I guess he's died already. He doesn't care.
Yes. Yes, that's true. I think there are numerous little micro holes here and there where he refers to death as if it's a real thing for him. But that doesn't bother me at all. Yeah, he's, we're going to die. Yeah, lovely. Lovely. Yeah.
There's a glee in it. It's the same glee he has when Lister's pregnant. It's that same cruel glee.
Yes.
It's more like, you're going to die.
Yes.
That's worth me dying to enjoy that happening to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the female cast a little bit. They are, I think, really good.
Yeah.
For what they have to do and for apparently how little rehearsal time they had. Female Lister and male Listers sync.
Yeah, really
dancing
good.
And drinking is
really, really good. Really good.
They actually do have a chemistry there, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And an amazing, what was the female Lister's name, the actress's name?
Angela Bruce.
Angela Bruce, that's it. She's fantastic, and I feel like I've seen her in loads of stuff.
Yeah,
you have, yeah.
If that was also with very little rehearsal time, I feel like that is a proper pro actor who's turned up and gone, right, what? Let me see you do some stuff. Right, that's your rhythm. You're like this. Bang, matched it. Because that's absolutely perfect. And the same with Rimmer as well, I think.
Yeah.
You know, she's not doing an impression of Chris Barry's Rimmer. She's doing Rimmer the way Chris Barry does Rimmer.
That's interesting.
If you see what I mean. I think they're both brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah. I think if it was me, if I was the actor turning up and going, oh, you've got to do them, you'd go, right, what do they do? And you'd do an impression of that character.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think they just kind of went, I felt like they were two, they cleverly booked two proper f***ing actors who came and did the job.
They really did. Maybe it's testament to the writing that the brief is so clear.
Yeah.
Although apparently Ed Bye was a little chagrined that they kind of created their own characters rather than watching old episodes of Red Dwarf, which they didn't do, apparently.
Amazing.
They're that good.
Amazing.
Especially with Rimmer's character. Apparently, like, she took her time finding the interpretation she'd do, and it stressed out Naylor and Ed Bye.
Right.
If you're a TV director, you do have a certain sense of urgency at all times. You do have to kind of be like, this is a BBC sitcom. We don't have time for character development. We don't have time to, you just find it by pretending.
Well, I'm glad that those actors did it the way that they did it, because I think they really nailed it. Yeah,
they really did. Do you have a particular moment or gag or scene or idea even in this episode that you would count amongst your favourites?
Oh, I mean, I've said a lot of them already. I think this is mine, all this is mine.
Yeah.
I better make myself look big. That's some great cat stuff. The dancing's fantastic. The worm do conversation. I should have taken notes as I went through it, but I was too frothy and giddy. The worm do thing when Lister clearly knows what the punchline is and is goading Rimmer into, like, very casually goading Rimmer into giving him the feed line so he can do the punchline. That's very nicely observed. Yeah, like you say, when they're back in the bunk room at the end, back in the bedroom, the whole great news, Listy, excellent news. I'm going to be an uncle. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, he has such a musicality. I think Chris Barry has such a musicality to his voice.
His rhythm is incredible, impeccable.
Yeah, and it's so weird to recognise that Crichton isn't in that one. Because I think of Crichton as having been there from the beginning, apart from that one episode where he's actually introduced, where he's all weird. Where he's weird.
the weird Crichton. That was the first episode of this series we're talking about. So the series is bookended with two characters who will come back permanently as of series three in the next episode.
Yes.
Talking of which, all good things must come to an end. Stu, you've given us so much time. Thank you so much for doing our silly podcast about Red Dwarf. Thank you for talking about it so beautifully. Some amazing insight there. Where can people find you?
People can find me, I suppose, via stuartgoldsmith.com. I've put all this work into my own website. It's on Wix. I'm not getting paid. I've got my website. I made it. I'm really proud of it. I'm really proud of all the things on it and all the stuff I do, which at the moment is stand up. I do my podcast where I interview millions and millions of comics. And I also do comedy about the climate. So I do comedy at my last show, Spoilers, is all about the climate crisis, which isn't a funny subject, but it's an award-winning show. Thank you very much. And it's like it's really funny and it works for, I do it for kind of, you know, sustainability departments in businesses and stuff to go
along. That's great.
Do stuff for their climate comms. So that, all of that and loads of other stuff, I'm spinning lots and lots of plates, but the Nexus is my own bloody website that I made myself, which is stuartgoldsmith.com.
That's lovely.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Stu.
Stuart Goldsmith. Fergus, are you happy?
I am now. That was brilliant. And I promised to stop saying this a few episodes ago, but I can't help it. Another fascinating insight.
Absolutely.
Another beautifully elegiac series of speeches about the show as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we're onto a good thing with this podcast. Like, people really like it when they like it, this Red Dwarf show.
Yeah, I am so happy with the way this is going. And Stu is just a superb guest. What a brilliant way to close off series two of Red Dwarf.
We talked a lot about his love of Red Dwarf.
Mm.
Which meant that we didn't get to every joke in the episode that I think is worth mentioning.
There's a few we neglected, yeah.
And a couple of bits to talk about. Matthew DeWitt, or Devitt, as Dog.
Oh, we didn't mention... Oh my God, I'm sorry, Matthew. We love you. Well, I do, anyway.
He's great. He's a great dog. He does... He maybe does, like, one of the better, like... opposite impressions.
Yeah.
Like he is a dog in the same way that Cat is Cat.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think I love him as the dog so much that's why I forgot to mention his performance, because I don't even think of there being an actor in there. I just love that dog. Trash My Shorts. Yeah.
Well, Trash My Shorts.
Trash My Shorts should... it's another one that should be in the lexicon. Why don't people say that in real life?
So when they came to characterise Cat, they thought Zoot Suit,
yeah.
Big Quiff, Little Richard...
Amazing fish earrings and all that, yeah.
Yeah. When they came to characterising Dog, they chose Hick.
They'd set up the American thing with Cat as well, right? So they have to play opposite that as well. So he has to be rural redneck.
Oh, yeah.
To be the opposite type of American. Because there are only two types of Americans. Sorry, American listeners. You think there's only one type of British person. So, you know, take the log out of your own eye.
Talking of amazing performances, Craig Charles, I think he's at his best when he's got to be bluntly honest.
Mm.
And would you like to join me for a cocktail? No. Is it too much to say that that is one of the funniest no's in history? Like, I find that no so funny. Almost funnier than the worm, do you think? Just the bluntness, no.
Yeah.
And the truth behind it. He wouldn't. Neither would anyone that Rimmer approaches asking if they wanted to join him. That is what Rimmer will hear.
Yes.
Rimmer will never get to do the worm do line. He will never get that far. Because the answer to, would you like to join Rimmer for a cocktail, is going to be, preferably in a blunt Scouse accent, no.
Yeah, yeah. It is a great line reading in an episode that's frankly full of them.
So full of them.
Norman's stuff with the, I mean, this is the scripting as well, but it's so brilliantly portrayed, as always, with Norman Lovett. The whole countdown, I've got a blind spot with sevens, and they're going to, I'll start lower down, one, blast off. That is just...
That's a great joke.
So great.
Annulling the idea of a countdown. Turns out he misses out three as well anyway, later on.
It makes
on.
No difference.
It's weird how the jokes have evolved. I think Ringo being a bad drummer is a cheap joke, but I also think that in the last kind of 20 years there's been a reappraisal of Ringo Starr as a drummer.
I was just going to say, yeah, that is the joke that proves something scientifically extraordinary, which is that we are in a parallel universe to the one in which this episode was written.
Oh.
Because everybody now can see that Rimmer is a good drummer.
We don't know about Rimmer's drumming capabilities.
Did I just say Rimmer?
Yeah. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see Rimmer taking old John Bonham style, like Moby Dick style drum solo. Yeah.
Oh, they wouldn't be. That's what they should. That's what Richard Curtis should have done for that movie yesterday. It shouldn't have been The World Wakes Up and We've All Forgotten the Beatles. It should have been The World Wakes Up and Forgot the Beatles because Rimmer was the drummer. That would have been... Because they would not have been successful. They would not have been successful with Rimmer on drums. And not because he has no sense of rhythm, because he's Rimmer.
Talking of Rimmer being Rimmer, I'm sorry to jump around. You're setting me up for so many... Just reminding me of so many good jokes in this episode. What was wrong with her? That doesn't actually get a laugh from the audience, the studio audience, much. I think there's a titter. But I went out with a girl once. What was wrong with her?
Yeah.
And the inevitability. There must be something wrong with her. And not just as a joke. He's not. Craig Charles isn't even playing Lister as saying that as a joke. He's like, genuinely, she went out with you, so what's wrong with her?
And Rimmer doesn't take that as a cheap shot either.
No. It's a formal, that's the next part of the conversation. Yeah. When Rimmer says, I've got out with someone. Again, it's like the inevitability of no being the answer to would you join me for a cocktail. The inevitability of what was wrong with her following I went out with someone. And does he does say he was getting jokes out like, who knows? Where are we going? Who knows? And then under his breath, just on the cut, while the audience is laughing, you hear him going, no cheap shots. Which means Rimmer's sense of humour is so basic and so crap that he thinks that who knows is a very clever pun, a very clever bit of wordplay.
It's the height of sophistication. I've got a beautifully written piece of funny for you. When the Listers realise they've slept together and they're trying to piece together what happened the night before, I remember betting you that I could climb the disco wall using only my lips.
Yes. There are some jokes. Wonderful. We talked about it in I cited actually that line, you ripped up and ate a photograph of his
yes,
wife. There are some lines just out of context.
Yeah.
Maybe because of the intonation, the reading of them, but they're just funny series of words on their own.
Lips is just the last thing.
Lips, perfect. Perfect. It's a very last, if you're talking about rug pulls in jokes, that's as late as you can leave a rug pull in a sentence.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's the last four letters.
Yes. And I can't think of a more perfect choice. Because the image is then, you then get the image of it.
Yes, that's the key.
Which is just beautiful.
And like the violence of ripping up Captain Hollister's wife's photo, it is funnier in our minds.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Than having seen it play out, I think.
100%. Well, a show that's so well written that you can climactically end an entire series with the words, I'm going to be an uncle, and that is full of malice and dread, depending on which character you are. Like, that's proper writing, that is.
And it's still funny, and the reveal, it pushes everything. Yeah.
I think it's quite funny in this episode. It really does show that Rimmer, if he was set in this century, would very much be an Andrew Tate incel sort of follower with all the pickup artist stuff. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
What was that book that came out when we were in our
20s? The Game.
The Game. Oh, my days. I feel like Rimmer would have definitely read The Game.
Yes.
Nish Kumar coming up again as Lister as well.
Yeah.
We're getting to a kind of final cast list. No, we're not.
No.
We're going to carry on for a while yet.
It is time to assess where we're up to, though, from series two, I think.
Should we do that in a little minisode between series, do you think? Should we have a little chat about that?
Let's do that.
Do a state of the world address kind of thing.
We'll talk about who's coming up in series three.
Oh, I mean, the ones we already know are. It's very exciting. What a series of telly and what a series of guests we have lined up for you, listener.
Trash my shorts, it's going to be good.
It's such sweet sorrow to say goodbye to another incredible series of Red Dwarf. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you for our little minisode next week.
And we're going to leave.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.